where he says, I am come to send fire on the earth, and what will I if it be already kindled? There are two baptisms, one by water and one by fire. The first is through John, and the second through Christ. The other question relates to it is, was the error of the Pharisees a spiritual sect, that they were fixed upon charity? As their righteousness was great, in what did it consist, and how is greater righteousness to be gained? You remember that Jesus on one occasion said, except your righteousness exceed that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will in no wise enter the kingdom. We'll start with the first part about sending fire on the earth, and what will I be already kindled. In the New English Bible version of this, it's translated in such a way that it seems to suggest that the thing is not already kindled and has to be started by Jesus in the time process. Unfortunately, this is not the best metaphysical expression of it. He is saying, I've arrived to start fire, set fire to everything, and already it is kindled because I have arrived, the thing has started. We know that if any being can respond to a stimulus, it must have inside itself something similar to the stimulus waiting to be activated. So we can say that if the stimulus has the character of a triangle, there must be a triangle possibility inside the receiving organism. So that when Christ says, I am come to start a fire on the earth, which means to destroy certain errors, the mere fact that he's talking to people at all and uses the expression start a fire means that he assumes that people have at least the elements of vocabulary inside themselves containing the word fire, that it means something to them. Funnily enough, the Pharisees are Persians, and the Persians, as you know, were fire worshippers. When the Jews were in captivity in Babylon, they learned quite a lot about Persian ideas. In fact, prior to the Babylonian captivity, there is no mention whatever of a spiritual doctrine amongst the Jews. They show a remarkable clarity of mind in material things, but no concept of spirit as we understand it. But when during the captivity there, they acquired certain Persian ideas, they assimilated these ideas to their already existing system of thought, and this produced a division in the Jews, and we find two sects, the Sadducees and the Pharisees, arguing about the way to look at reality. The Sadducees believe that if you behave yourself very well on earth, you will receive reward on earth materially. You will honor your father and your mother that you might live a long time on the land that your fathers have bequeathed to you. It's obvious that the Sadducees, as a sect, must be materially very wealthy, otherwise they won't believe this kind of idea. This idea justifies them being wealthy. The Pharisees, on the other hand, are striving to acquire something other than the material benefits, precisely because their ideas were absorbed in a period when they were in captivity and had no material possession to stress. It is a well-known fact that any organism will strive to survive in any kind of environment. There are certain kinds of bacteria which are so resistant to boiling that you can boil them for several hours without killing them. What they do is they blow themselves a little bubble, and they go and hide inside it till the boiling is finished. And when the thing has cooled down again, they revert back to their original form. Now the Jews are rather like this historically. They are chameleons. Consequently, they change their form, like these bacteria, in the boiling process. When they have no money, they are very, very spiritual. When they have a lot of material possessions, they are very sensible and realistic. and they can understand in the days of their success that God is willing them success where they're getting it. But if they have no material success, say during the great European persecutions in Poland or Russia, they become totally spiritual, showing this kind of capacity that the bacteria have for changing form in order to resist the boiling process. They are typical of the life organism adapting itself to any kind of situation. The righteousness of the Pharisees is the righteousness of men who have done this with their consciousness. If we write Persia in here, we know what this word means. Basically, it means affirmation of the rational process. To be quite logical is to be Persian in this sense. Persian religion was based on a dualism of good and evil, of black and white, of water and desert, of fertile and unfertile. A series of pairs of opposites. Now, pi ratio, that ratio of the diameter to the circumference of a circle. When we use the concept of opposition, of opposites in logic, we draw a diameter to a circle and write on one point of the diameter, one term, I extract the perimeter, hot. You go right to the centre of the circle, to the other perimeter, and write cold. This is why we use the word opposite. It means posited on the orb, ob, posited. And the B becomes P before another P, for phonetic reasons. So, when we're thinking rationally, we think in terms of opposite, near, far, and so on. As we move towards the centre of the circle, from the perimeter, we come to a zone of indeterminacy where the opposite terms are not applicable. Now, the Pharisees are the men who like to be clear. Clarity is their aim. They are men who have decided it's a good thing to live in the head. There's our man with three parts slung on the spinal cord. The pi-rational process is in the head. And men who aim at clarity of reason progressively become cold. If you wish to be rational, you must be formally clear. And if you are formally clear, you must keep away from the center of the wheel. Suppose we write hot on one term, and on the other end of the diameter cold, we can say the greatest opposition is on the perimeter, at the ends of the diameter. And as we move towards the center, it is going less and less and less hot, and less and less and less cold. So right in the center, we can write neither hot nor cold. This is indeterminate. This is indifferent. And say not different. We cannot tell in the center whether we are talking about not hot or not cold. Now this isn't clear enough for the Pharisaic mind. Those who take a concept like worshipping God and ignoring God. Worshipping God might mean doing everything you do, including brushing your teeth, with due regard to cosmic form, which would require quite a lot of analysis about shape and size and number of God's teeth and the cavity between, what size of bristle to use, and so on. This is the kind of thing that occupies the Pharisaic mind, the rational mind. If you care to read through Deuteronomy, you will find quite a system of laws there, illustrating this kind of thing. If you read all the law bits in the Old Testament, you will find they're quite detailed. And if you then, because you've got a little time left over, read the whole of the Talmudic commentaries, you'll find some more details worked out. Now the Pharisees were these rationalists who were trying to devise a kind of worship that would be clearly defined so that every man would know just precisely what was and what not a righteous act. In China, Confucius was trying to do the same thing. And we know that under Confucianism, even the size of your father's burial what determined exactly. So that it would be bad form if you were to get yourself, say, in European parlance, a centimetre too fat, halfway up the vase. This was undoubtedly because the ancestral spirits were very annoyed and they didn't feel the number of carrots that grew in the coming year. Confucianism was Confucianism. In fact, politically, when Confucius was given the territory to govern by his rational method, he failed dismally, just as Plato failed when he tried to apply his rational principles of government outlined in the Republic. So this begins to make sense of Christ's statement that we'd better exceed the righteousness of the Pharisees. But he didn't talk nonsense, he talked sense. The Pharisees are aiming at clarity, and to get this clarity they have to define. Define, if we remember, indicates the limits of the application of terms. We do not define things in the world. They are already adequately defined. If you put your finger in a fire, it will burn you, because the fire is adequately defined already. Whether you apply the term fire to it, or fire, or fur, or whatever you catch for it, it will go on burning you, because its nature is defined naturally. So we do not define the things of the world. They are already adequately defined. What we define is the limits of the application of terms. Now this has been forgotten in philosophy to such a degree that most people say define such and such a thing, form. And the average professor of philosophy will then proceed to define the thing. At least he believes he did so. He is not. He is defining the limits of the application of terms. Now if we go back to our parasitic diagram, and we start defining what hot is, as we are moving towards its opposite cold, we must come to the central point, which is neither hot nor cold. Two negatives. Not hot, not cold. Now the fun thing about the negative is this. It is no definition at all. It's simply the rubbing out of a definition. So if I said it's neither hot nor cold, nor is it two tomatoes. These are negations. There's no relation between the tomatoes and the hot and the cold. But it's just as much not tomato as not hot and not cold. So this zone of negation in the middle, the end zone, cannot be handled by the man who thinks in pairs of opposites. He has to say that for practical reasons, that is, for practical purposes, purposes of action, we can say when we put our finger in the fire, this fire is so hot that I'd better not leave it in. But this fire is not so hot that I should take it out immediately. And this fire is not so hot that I can't leave it in all night, because in fact this fire has gone out. This is called an outgone fire. Now if you apply the terms carefully, you'll find that the fire that's gone out is fire. And yet you can use the expression of gone out of fire and remake it. The centre of negation in the wheel here is obviously full of more righteousness than there is on the perimeter. There's plenty of opposition between hot and cold. If you sit in a cold bath of water, jump out, let the water out, fill it up with boiling water and jump back again, you will feel the difference. And if you put it with lukewarm water in the first place and jump in and out twice, you won't feel the difference. If we examine this centre of negation, we find that at the point of approach to it, our discrimination must become very, very, very fine before we can decide at what point to stop using the term less hot and start using the term less cold. Now, in the kinetic theory of heat used in physics, heat is quite simply motion. Kinetic theory says heat is motion, and wherever there is motion, there is heat. Now, if this is a correct definition, and physics says it is, or to say physicists say so, then there is no such thing as cold at all. There can only be the means of heat. Lots of heat, less heat, less heat, less heat, less heat. But if anything exists, because a thing is a motion compound, that thing must have a temperature. So we can say that the absolute zero is an existential unattainable. Science is trying to get down to absolute zero. It's come down to about half a point plus. But to get to absolute zero, it would have to get to non-existence, because things are actually motion compounds and motion is heat. So when we start defining hot, less hot, less hot, less hot, instead of going at the center into cold, we should say still less hot, still less hot, and so on. We must exceed the righteousness of the fellows who think in pairs of opposites. Men who think in pairs of opposites, if they were to get into the government, or if they were to be by magic placed on the bench in a court, if we were to make one of them arbitrarily by act of will into a high court judge, and he presumed that he could say hot and cold about the given case, he would be a nuisance. What we actually find is that the more intelligent the judge, the more elastic he is in definition. And that he defines the situation, that is, the application of terms, in such a way that it produces some good for some being, maybe for society, maybe for himself. But he's always got the good of some being at heart when he's making a definition. And consequently, he cannot accept the straight hot cold or the good evil. The funny thing about the definition of evil used by theologians is this. Good is called pure being, and evil is an absolute negation of being. But a negation of being is no being at all. So that evil has no being. And therefore there is no such thing as an existential evil by this definition. Comes with me, if one man pokes another man's eye, there is not an absolute evil, although he loses an eye. Because if he poked it out efficiently, there was something that wasn't evil, namely his deficiency. And if he poked it out with a good strong finger, the finger is a good strong finger, and good is not evil. So we find that the use of pairs of opposites lands us in the existential situation in a position where we cannot apply. In the case of the Pharisees, they were trying to define all righteous acts and all wrongful acts. And they would do such things as counting the number of strands of cotton hanging down off their scarf, or silky they would afford them, tzitzis, the fringes. And the longer your fringes, the more virtuous you were. And the more money you had, the longer your fringes. Now, Frank is complaining that there's an illogicality about this. That the length of fringe is not quite the same thing as the meaning of the word spirit. So we can't make an equation that says spirit equals long fringes. Which is what, in fact, they were tending to do. Because as they gained in clarity, so they gained in perspicacity in the commercial field. They found that they could actually define situations in such a way that they came out on top in the social system. They were bright, they were doing as well as the Sadducees, in fact, by their definitions. And they were saying our logic, and we must remember this log is the same thing as logos, which is the name of Christ in the Gospel of John. Their logic or rationale of the universe was so clear that they finished up at the top level of society, pushing about all the other beings that weren't clear. And they defined their clarity as a good. They could see, in fact, that their clarity had gained for them many of the things called goods. Therefore, they were worshipping their clarity. They were not worshipping the sense of negation, which includes the pairs of opposites. They weren't worshipping God, free spirit. They were worshipping clarity or know-how in the social setting. And in the process, they were causing injury to people of less sharp wits. Now, Christ knew very well that if they were to carry on in the way they were doing with their heightened clarity, they would seize the dominion of society completely. And they would then begin to rest upon their clarity. The peculiar thing about the rational mind is that it defines everything in a circle and its opposites on the perimeter of the circle. And because of the nature of the rational response, the tendency to formally equate sense percepts, they would rapidly begin to think they knew everything. They would have tradition, they had built it up, and they would be able to say, we know what is happening because we know the law. In Babylon, from the Chaldean astronomers, they had acquired the law of the eternal recurrence of celestial events. They knew about astronomy, they knew how to predict a solar eclipse and fool ignorant people with their knowledge. They began to think that they knew exactly what to do in any given situation. But in fact, they were being dictated to by the past. They had no idea of another level of being where form is of no moment at all, namely the level of free will. Christ described spirit as free. He says, God is a spirit, and you cannot tell where the spirit goes to or from. He defines every man born of spirit exactly in the same way. The man who is free is the man who is unpredictable. But the unpredictable man cannot be rationalized by any other man. Let us say, insofar as you cannot reasonably say what a man is going to do, he is not prior predictable. To be predictable is simply to be in such a position that somebody can say rationally from your formal behavior what you are going to do. But the free man is not formally determined at all. He's determined by will, not by form. And all the time that the rationalists are tying the world up, and the Pharisees are a type of rationalists, there are new emergence, biological emergence, new types of changes occurring in the cells on the human race. New ways of looking at things are emerging. Radiation from outer space can change the formal structure of the factors of humanity in the egg. A being can be born with characteristics not previously possessed by other beings of the same family. So that the rationalist who has gained his position entirely by study of the past and application of logic to it finds himself in relation to the mutant, the new character emergent in the new age, quite in the dark. He cannot say what it is going to do. So although looking back at tradition, he knows all that it says in the book, and although he knows exactly the cycle of events within his society, he does not know what is going to happen with the new baby that appears. Christ is like a mutant. Imagine today with radiation techniques. In America, about 5 years ago, some scientists said, with our present knowledge of radiation, we are on the way to being able to determine the characters that a person will be born with. And therefore, we are on the way to being able to create genius. And we might make a man who will be able to see the truth about reality. And at this point, another man stood up, and in the name of the HR or head of function, said, if such a man is produced, it will be our social duty to cure him, because he will disrupt our cycle of events. He will spoil our predictions. Now, in exactly the same way, when the three kings in the story, the three centers of being in your own organism, they go visiting a new baby. And this new baby is a mutant. That is to say, he's a change in the biological structure. From Abraham, efforts have been made in a certain direction. These efforts have accumulated. Instead of giving birth to a musical Mozart, a philosophical, metaphysical giant has been produced by these continuous biological strivings. This baby is born with the potential of pure reason and pure will, and his reason is entirely subject to his will, although his reason is pure. He doesn't have to obey the mechanics of reason. He will do so. But he will apply those aspects of the reason that are applicable with due regard to the necessary movement of evolution of the human race. Now, those people already in possession, the Pharisees and the others, who have everything tied up, they don't want a man to give a new dispensation. They want everything in their own hands, in their own family's hands. They don't even observe the old law that says after so many years, all the lands that have been taken away from the poor by the rich, all those possessions taken away from the dull witted by the sharp witted, shall be returned to the dull witted, and a fresh start shall be had. This is the idea behind an old Jewish dispensation, which in a certain number of years was stated to be a necessary social thing. If we don't return to the people, to the families that we have robbed, the things we have taken from them, we will build a static society with haves at the top and haves not at the bottom. And therefore there was a Jewish law saying these things must be returned. But in fact, in his day, these things were not being returned. They were breaking the law. They had a law and they were not keeping it. So their righteousness was not yet made perfect. They were only obeying the law insofar as it suited their private purpose. Now he knew the history of the Jews, and he knew that these Pharisees derived their particular concepts from Persia, from rationalism. And he knew that the Persians, as fire worshippers, were using the same symbol, pyre, to mean fire and reason. So P-Y-R-E means fire, and exactly the same elements mean reason. So the ancients, at some point, had a clear view that there is no reason other than the forms precipitated by energy. Fire is a symbol of energy. Heraclitus was a Greek called the obscure philosopher, precisely because he said energy makes reason. People couldn't understand it. The Greeks were trying to understand it. They were trying to be logical. And they thought that logic, which they thought was reason, was opposed to the pure impulse of the will. So that Apollo, who is the god of order, of Pyro, of reason, situated in the head, was an enemy of Dionysus, situated in the belly. So the rationalizing Greeks committed the kind of error that the Pharisees committed. They tried logically to tie everything up so that they would understand precisely what to do about everything in man's life. If you read Plato's Republic, you read a book that is taken seriously in universities all over the world, as if it were a serious treatise on government, when in fact no government in the world could possibly take that book as a textbook and apply it. And when Plato tried to, he failed. A simple division of society into men who can think clearly and control the situation, warriors who will fight like men, and ordinary working people. It's a very nice, easy way of dividing things, but it does not correspond with existential people. Because, unfortunately, people can think a bit and fight a bit and work a bit in varying degrees. And you can't find a man who can work but doesn't want to fight sometimes if you push him. You can't find a man who will work who is not able to think a bit, fight a bit, or a man who can fight but can't work a bit and think a bit, or a thinker who can't fight a bit if it's only verbally, and labour a bit if it's only in a dictionary. So this division is existentially untrue. Dionysus is the god of the life impulse, non-rationalized. This Dionysus, the first part of the word is God. The last part of the word is Savior. The middle part of the word means no yes. It's this peculiar center of indefinition, where the hot and the cold cannot be distinguished. Apollo is the principle of rationality. He is the god who has cattle. In the myth, that Hermes and the fire steal. Cattle means fixed animals. Animals heads in. Animals control. But if the Dionysian force is the force of God himself saving people from rationality by pointing out that yes, no, cannot be resolved in the center. There is no pure black or pure white existentially in the void without the presence of its opposite. So, somehow, if we are to get into the kingdom of balance called heaven, if we are to see that hot and cold are equally valid, that is to say, the terms hot and cold have an application, but the existential fact that they refer to is not a duality at all. As we see, if we take near far, and I get my pencil, I will take it near to the board. I'll start where my knee is. There it is. Now it is far from the board, and I'm going less far, less far, less far, less far, less far, less far. When am I going to say, now I am near the board? Why not start here on the knee again and say, I'm not as near to the board as I will be in a moment. I'm getting nearer and nearer and nearer and nearer. In each space that I break my pencil, I can say either I am less far or more near than I was before. So in each space I can use both terms, near, far. So in each space I can say yes, no. So in the Dionysian figure, we have God, and then no, yes, and then sus, which means safe. We can swap our definition and still mean exactly the same thing. Only it doesn't sound like the same thing. So if we say to the frontline soldier, you are a hero, there is the cannon's mouth, here is the book of history, here is my pen ready to write your name, the moment you get in the cannon's mouth. Here is the history book, here is the cannon, and here are you. Now are you ready? Yes. Go. And he goes. And we bring him back again. Fresh incarnation, fresh start, new body. We now say to him, over there is a highly explosive device. And when you get near to it, there's a funny man behind it, and he'll touch a certain little spot, and he will probably fall apart, and you'll need a fresh start. And on the other hand, here we have a funny little pile of papers tied together, like a lapel, and spread over the surface of the paper are lots of little bits of wiggly ink. Are you ready? Then go. Now you can't make the equation between being blown to bits and the little wiggly shapes of ink on the surface of the book. So he tends not to move. Whichever definition we use in the situation, if he doesn't know the rules, he will either be precipitated into the cannon's mouth or confused by what we have just said. The man who can handle the yes-no stimulus in the situation can determine the behavior of the man who can't. So that Spinoza said, if you remember, adequate knowledge equals adequate response, activity, happiness. Inadequate knowledge, inadequate response, passivity, misery. If you know all about it, you can dodge those men that know all about it or shake hands with them. If you know less than all about it, the man that knows all about it could, if he had an intent so to do, fool you into doing so. Now, the men that have everything under control, the Pharisees, the rationalists, and other people, who thought everything was under control, are threatened by Christ with fire. And he's going back to the statement of Heraclitus, who is 500 years before him, who says that the logos, the ratio of forms in the universe, is fire. That idea is will. That reason is only will. That all your intellectual activities are merely ways that your will behaves. Now, supposing we draw a circle to represent a form. How did the form get there? We know how it got there. Forces came into it and rotated for a time, and when they're ready, they go out. That's the sound of choice. Now, where the forces are rotating, we can rationalize about it because we can draw our diameter through it. But before the forces have come in and started to rotate, and after they have gone out, from the rotation, we can say rationally nothing whatever about them. All we can say about them is that they are energy that can generate a circle and may not. So Heraclitus, when he says the logos is fire, that the form of the world is energy, he's saying that energy is formulating itself. And as it brings to be the form of the world, likewise it departs from it and the form of the world disappears. Now the rationalizing Greeks didn't like this thing. Not at all. Because if this statement is true, then all the structures that they are trying to make will one day disappear. Now imagine a Greek temple like the Parthenon. Imagine they built it to exact geometrical proportions. Take one of the Greeks who first saw it put up, an intelligent man. Suddenly switch him into the 20th century and let him have a brochure from one of the airlines, visit to Greece and see the ruins. He wouldn't like it. He'd use all his geometrical knowledge to set up a monument to his eternal God. Only his monument has fallen down. This said something about his God. His God has fallen down, too. The God is the governing concept in a man that helps him to move in the way he moves. If he has a false concept, he's got a false God, and his concept causes him to fall down in practice in the world. So he'd better get himself a better concept or go beyond concept. Now the highest concept of all, formally, is the concept of reason, of pi ratio, of the logos itself. But then the concept of the logos, the highest one, is that there is no form other than energy formulated. There are no forms, spheres, ultimate particles, subatomic particles, electrons, protons, magnetrons, barotrons, and all the electrons there are. There are no forms whatever that are not simply behaviors of energy. And this energy is predictable, paradictable, rationally talkable about, only insofar as it is rotating at the time you make your observation. And you've no guarantee whatever that when you made your observation of this molecular or atomic structure, that it will be there in a moment. Let the balance of forces in the galactic system alter ever so slightly, and the solar system will go out of balance. All the rules on the Earth will change. If we take certain material elements today and do experiments, say in supercooling, which is a relatively new study, we find funny things like a liquid will flow uphill instead of downhill. Now this was unthinkable when you were at school a few years ago. But it is a commonplace at certain other levels. We're used to gravity and things falling down. Anti-gravity is a serious study. We're used to expecting to fall if we come to the edge of a precipice. There's no guarantee. If the molecular forces holding your body together were to slacken ever so slightly so that the molecular distances were to increase, you wouldn't fall. You either carry on walking on a straight line in midair, or you might fly up, or you might just disintegrate completely through lack of cohesion power in the molecules. Now, nobody can say from rational principle, that is from the consideration of the cycle of events, what is happening in the non-cyclic energy that has so far generated that cyclic event. So when Christ says we have to get a righteousness exceeding that of the Pharisees, greater than that of rationalists, he says we must have a mind that is open to possibilities that the reason has never seen. You remember the little poetic line, reason has moons, but moons not hers lie mirrored on her seas, confounding her astronomers, but oh, delighting me. Reason has moons. Moons, the base of the word, means to count, to measure, mensuration. And the moon is also symbolic of phasic change. Reason has phases, but there are phases that the reason cannot account for, and these are the ones where the no yes is in the middle, where anything can happen. The realm of faith, when a person can change suddenly from a dying man under an operation to a recovering man, or a man that's come through an operation successfully, physically, can take a dive and die, because a change has occurred at the level where opposition of the logical thought has no application. First surgeries come to set fire to the rationalists, the men that think they've got everything under control. He attacks very vigorously the whole structure of the Jewish society of his day, and not only that, but of the Roman society of his day, whence the Romans feel they can participate in the crucifixion. He refuses to speak to Pilate because Pilate, is a rationalist and wants a definition of truth. How can he possibly define truth to a rationalist who believes, for instance, that the word truth is the opposite of the word falsity or untruth? Supposing a man believes that the word truth is the opposite of untruth, is it possible to tell an untruth if this definition is correct? When you speak, words come out of your mouth. Supposing I say 2 and 2 are 5, have I told an untruth? Have I made a false statement? All I've done is taken a row of words out of the dictionary and uttered them. I might be meaning anything. I might mean 2 people, a man and a woman, and 2 other people, a man and a woman, both got married, these 2 couples, they both tried to have a baby, and only one pair succeeded. And when I counted them up, then there were 5. This is a biological truth. The mathematical one is merely a convenient definition. So that we cannot say that any statement whatever is untrue in the ultimate sense, because whatever is true. So that the words that come out, which are said to be lies, are only said to be lies because lie comes from the verb to lay, and the lie is something laid down, and a pretense is made that it applies beyond the face level. Yet it does so. The whole of the laws of a country are lies. Law is from the verb to lay. That which is laid down is a lie. And yet these lies are the grounds of social truth. How can you explain this kind of truth to a rationalist who thinks in pairs of opposites? It isn't possible to do so. So what we have to do, if we want to exceed the righteousness of the Pharisees, we must realize that we can never, by means of logic, based on pairs of opposites, near, far, high, low, good, bad, and so on, come to the ultimate existential meaning of any proposition at all. This means that we must continuously remind ourselves that when we do not define things, we define the limits of the application of terms. And we have to know what the limits are before we can, in fact, define them. Have you got any particular questions about this?
You said on one occasion, Christ, one of his motives in attacking the system of the day was more to test himself and his own bodily dislike of the concepts he evolved himself.
Mm-hmm.
To avoid a schism himself. See, this time the best way would be to be able to pin him up to a donor's name, which he knew they wouldn't like, and react accordingly.
Mm-hmm.
It's as though he was treating the rest of mankind as an entity which would behave in a certain way. He reduced mankind to the sort of all men to one man, as it were.
Means for maintenance.
Yeah.
Well, if you remember when we were discussing this problem at that time, we were talking about a certain aspect of the human side of Christ in the existential situation. When he's in Gethsemane arguing with himself and with God about whether he shall go through with this drama, it's his human side, not the divine side, that is doing the complaining. You have a physical body, and if you set out to do a certain thing, and when you're about to do it, we all jump on you. And the thing is terribly important for you to do, and we won't let you do it. Your flesh will complain and you will fail. Even if you can see rationally that we number sufficiently to stop you doing it, the tendency in your body will be there, won't it?
Wouldn't that depend on exactly how clearly you saw it?
This must be done, then. If you see it clearly enough, you'll stop fighting. Now, in Gethsemane, the human side of Christ is arguing to get the clarity enough to go on with the job.
The divine side is arguing.
The human side is doing the complaint. He has his orders from the divine side, and the body is saying, well, it's still painful. So he says, I don't want to do it. And the divine side says, it must be done by someone. And there's been an awful lot of prophets predicting that it is you. Now you've arrived. Are you going to be like Jonah and run away from the situation and refuse to frighten the Ninevites on the ground that they might reform? Or are you going to accept it? He says that he sweat blood during this fight between the divine logic and the human flesh in himself. You have this argument.
The divine can't
lose,
and
it
must know
this. The divine knows it. Hmm. Confounding enough, the human doesn't.
Well, where is the measure of identification?
You mean the mechanics of the divine identification? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Before we deal with that, we'd have to go back to your point about Christ behaving as if the rest of humanity were one man, namely a mechanical man. He came to remind them of their potential freedom. And he said to the Pharisees, you will not go in to that free spiritual domain, neither will you let anybody else go. You are not being free. He had come to be free, and they were not being free. So their behavior convinced him that they were mechanical. And therefore, he had to move along the Via Dolorosa to the cross, in order to convict them of mechanicality. They didn't believe they were mechanical. But 2,000 years of argument have suggested that they were very mechanical. Because he annoyed them, and they responded in a way that if they could have seen the 2,000 years of persecution following his death, they would not have done what they did. When they said, his blood be upon our head, upon our children, they didn't think it was serious that that blood would be there. So they factually responded mechanically to the stimulus situation. He said, I will bring fire and I will destroy your fire. Your rationalizing, which is an energy, has got in the groove. Now I bring you free fire, and this free fire will set fire to your bound fire and release it. And they fought for the maintenance of their rational structure of society. And he set fire to it, and he pushed them to the point where they reacted to him by crucifying him. And he said, I, when I be lifted up, will draw all men to me. First he agitated, spread the thing over a sufficient length of time to get a sufficient number of people interested and emotionally charged about it. Then he was crucified. So that the figure of him crucified has been controversial for 2,000 years. And this could only have happened if they were responding mechanically. Therefore, on the cross, he says, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. But if they are mechanical. People that don't know what they're doing are mechanical. They're responding to a stimulus.
Well, they're people.
Yes, they're people, technically.
They're worthy of.
They are bending the knee to the stimulus. Now let's go to the point about identification. Let's put the line here and say down below here is a triangle representing humanity, and up here is a triangle representing God. Now the triangle below is concentrating on its finite center, and the triangle above is radiating infinitely. Now that is exactly the relation between the individualized human being who is focused on his body, whilst the divine is focused on the field which is infinite. So the divine can feel the struggle of the individual within itself, whilst the individual struggling cannot feel the field. So the argument goes, I, petty egoic self, don't like being pushed about by this field. I don't even know if the field exists. If you ask yourself seriously, with perfect honesty, rare commodity, whether looking at your physical body, you don't think your physical body is more real than your feelings? Do you? You think it is? And yet it isn't. Even in physical terms, it isn't, is it? Because you know that your physical structures are simply modalities of the field. And the field is, in principle, infinite. The field is more real than any particular modality of it. And your physical body is simply a locus of a certain type of activity with which you are identified. And you know that that particular corpus which you focus on has within itself the inherences of disintegration. Namely, death will arrive. It is appointed to man once to die. You were born, you will die. This is the thing about your physical body. How can you believe, logically, that your physical body is more real than the field which precipitated it and which will disintegrate it?
Well, this is only just
You mean it's a merely intellectual proposition of the moment? Right. You're in a personal and private Gethsemane. The field is talking to you and saying, look, I'm here, I'm infinite. And today, in the 20th century, it says, you know what? I'm even a scientific proposition these days. How can you resist me? And then your finite, focused, corporeal center says, I still don't believe it.
What is the
advantage? The field?
No, to resist the field. Somewhere, somebody is getting energy to resist something else.
The field supplies the finite individual with the energy to resist the field in order to characterize the individual. That is, even your disbelief in God is imposed on you by God. So you can understand what it means to be isolated and fulfill the total gamut of experience. You'd be deficient if you didn't occasionally become atheist. How could you possibly comprehend an atheist if you didn't know what it was like? So if you could lead him to salvation, which a part of him would like to, for comfort, you'd have been there already. But you're not allowed there. There's a fiery sword down the Garden of Eden keeping you up until you've got sufficient character to make it worthwhile for God to talk to you and say, how did you go on? Because if you're not formally characterized, you're not worth talking to, are you?
Okay.
You want to?
Well, you've got me, I don't
think.
But
it's still so much
information.
Information, yes. You are being formed on the inside in the discussion. And the nature of the form is such that it will not allow an equilibration of a counter mechanism based on the material existence. Will it?
Well,
this
is
so
much more information. I mean, this could work.
Because it can.
Yes.
Can you put your fingers in your ears, or is it too late?
Well, once you
realize
it can work, maybe it won't.
Well, you know the Indian story about this, a man he was going up the staircase. And then he shoved it the wrong way up and turned down and wanted to go down again. But somebody had set fire to the staircase below him. He can't move. This is the same thing as I bring fire to burn out the rationalism of the policy. The staircase is simply your experience. And you are ascending in self-knowledge. And you assess the universe at each step. And you have everything signed up when you were a little boy. All you had ambition for at one point of your life was a nice red rubber ball without pictures that would bounce high. Mm-hmm. Not one with pictures that bounce low. When you got this ball, it hadn't. But there's no end to your ambition. You went on from ball to bat to bicycle, to bike, to motorbike, to car. And now we're looking into outer space. There's no limit to it. There's no limit to the ambition of egotism. And there's no limit to the field. There can be no limit to egotism because there is no limit to the field. It is the field that is feeding the egotism to force it to characterize itself infinitely, to make it worth the field of time having such an egotism. So your worst crime is divinely inspired. Because it makes you an interesting character.
What about the field conscious man that's manifesting a form in the material world in a magical sense?
He is identified with the field. Otherwise, he just can't formulate in that way. He is a non-dualist. He's not the dualist utilizing the field. He's a non-dualist utilizing himself in his infinity.
In that sense, would that mean that his own vehicle was of no more consequence for him than for somebody else's?
There is nobody else.
No, but in the
I was talking to a woman the other day, and she was saying that she believed that a play she had seen, it was a TV thing, and so now it's nothing marvelous. In this play, a woman who loves a man commits suicide on purpose because he doesn't love her. Before she commits suicide, she studies the black art. And after she's dead, she gathers together her astral body and she enters into the body of a girl that he loves and forces this girl's psyche out. So she can't get the benefit. Now, is she identified with the field? She's a dualist because she forced the other woman out. Now, if she'd have been a non-dualist, she wouldn't have needed to commit suicide because she would have recognized that this other girl was just another body of hers. She could have enjoyed the enjoyment in that body directly without bothering to polish off the one she started with. Again, it's a matter of the definition of terms. If you're a monist, you're in trouble, because if monism is true, then the salvation of one man is the salvation of all. If you're a dualist, there are two ultimate terms, good and evil, which can never be resolved and must always be in conflict. But if you're a non-dualist, you just deny all the financing boundaries, whatever, identify with the infinite field, and proceed to enjoy all the operations that are taking place in all vehicles throughout infinite space. Can be done. It's called the precarious enjoyment. If you read the poetry called Mr. Weston, the Good One, you read of a woman in there called Mrs. Buster. she vicariously enjoined the seduction of all maidens in the village. That although she herself was not seduced, she arranged it. And her only joy was arranging seduction. Thank you.